This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity, given in 1923. This is the last lecture, lecture 13, and then there's also going to be a small extract from a concluding address that will be part 14 of this, but this is technically the last lecture. It will be seen from what was said in the last lecture concerning the connection between the evolution of the world and that of man, that the task of the whole evolution of both for the present period is man's gradual attainment of freedom. When we glance back at the past evolution of the world, we find that man, as regards his most important activities, standing upright, speaking, and thinking, has been prepared by divine spiritual beings higher than himself, and that between death and rebirth, he is always led again into the company of these beings, in order that what has been brought about in him during his earth existence, although he is then unconscious of it, may work further. I described how man, by the forces of sun and moon, and then in the sun region by those of Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, is led into the world of the stars, which means, of course, what corresponds spiritually to the world of the stars. I should just like to say, in addition, that when in man's life, between death and rebirth, after having gone so far in the region of the planetoids as to receive the Saturn impulse, he turns back again, he encounters on his return journey the highest divine spiritual beings of the first hierarchy, the thrones, cherubim and seraphim. These are they who include in their impulses both spiritual and natural existence, for not only do they permeate, animate, and spiritualize the laws of nature, but they also bring the moral life of the whole cosmos into continuous harmony with the laws of nature. They are beings who, although they never appear in any form of physical manifestation, yet in the spiritual world exercise an inconceivable and tremendous power over the earth, by means of which they can unceasingly bring the moral laws into harmonious accord with the laws of nature. Thus man, through having been able constantly to vivify the impulse of the past during his extra-earthly existence, is also enabled to use his evolution to work in the sense of this impulse. In the present epoch of the evolution of the world and humanity, the task of man is to undertake, of his own free will, what in the past was brought about in him in a state of unfreedom by a higher ordinance. Now when we survey the evolution of the world of humanity, we find that the crisis through which man had to pass, leading from the former determination of his being, from the former absolute guidance by divine spiritual beings, to the conscious working of his way up to the knowledge of these spiritual beings, whereby he will attain his freedom, that this crisis occurred at a quite clearly defined time. These things are always approximate, for the reckoning of time was not quite the same then as now. But taking our present method of reckoning, we find the crisis occurring some 333 years after the mystery of Golgotha. That was the great critical moment. Looking back at that critical period of the evolution of the world and humanity, beyond which we now stand, we can describe it in somewhat the following way. If the evolution of man and of the earth itself had continued as it was, if man had remained solely under the influence of those divine spiritual powers which had guided humanity till that time, he would still have progressed to freedom, such being the intention of the divine spiritual beings. But what would that have signified? It would have meant that the balance between the two parts of man's astral body would have been disturbed at that time. I shall now describe the astral body in this connection, leaving out for the time being the connection of the physical human body and the etheric human body. This astral body, before the year 333, was such that the greater part, the more active part of it, was in the upper man, and the less active part in the lower man, the middle man lying between the two. By reason of the upper part of the astral body being more powerful in those olden times, the higher divine spiritual beings were able to exercise through it their great influence on human beings. It was part of the plan for the whole evolution of humanity that it should progress in a certain way. While that was the condition of man's astral body, about 3000 BC, at about 1000 BC, the lower part of the astral body had considerably increased in size, while the upper part had proportionately decreased. In the year 333 AD, however, the upper part of the astral body was about equal in size to the lower. This was the crisis that occurred in the year 333 AD. Since that time, the upper part of the astral body has constantly decreased in size, and man's development is furthered by this. We cannot, therefore, follow the evolution of humanity in its actuality unless we consider the change in the astral body of man in the course of the earth's evolution. If man had not experienced this diminution of the upper part of his astral body, the ego would not have gained sufficient influence. He would never have become free. This decreasing of the astral has therefore served to promote his free spiritual activity. On the other hand, as I have already said, things do not run such a course that a man could ask, why did not the gods organize everything in a way pleasing to man? The gods ought to have so organized the universe as to make that possible. Much of what is most pleasing to man rests upon something different, which, were he to understand it, would not please him at all. This decreasing of the astral body is connected with something besides its size in the upper man. The strength through which man can be master of his physical and etheric bodies does not depend on the whole astral body, but on the size of the upper half. Thus humanity was really confronted with the fact that through the diminutions of the astral body, the health of all humanity must gradually become weaker. We only form a true picture of the evolution of man when we know his freedom had to be purchased at the price of illness everywhere. Not, of course, appearing in the form of cholera or typhus, but as a gradual sickening of humanity the whole earth over. Freedom could be bought in no other way than by the illness, so to speak, of all humanity. Thus it was, in a sense, preordained that actually after the year 333, if all the forces had continued as they were, men on earth would have become weaker and weaker, more and more feeble. The end of the earth would have come about through the complete dying out of humanity. However, there came about what I can describe in the following way. That assembly of divine spiritual beings, whom I described as having their dwelling place on the sun, decided to send down to earth their ambassador, the Christ, that he might go through that experience which was the very first of the kind undergone by those divine spiritual beings connected with humanity. For man goes through birth and death. These experiences enter into the earth life of man, and are not to be thought of as the materialist imagines them. None of the divine spiritual beings above man, from the angels, archangels, up to the highest, know death, though they undergo metamorphosis. They are not born, nor do they die, but change from one form to another. Man too changes his form, but in so doing he puts off his physical and etheric body, and therefore the fact of birth and death is to him a radically different experience from what it could be to any of the higher hierarchies. The leaders of the solar harmonies and of the sun impulses then decided to send Christ down to the earth so that one of those beings who have no experience of birth and death should undergo that purely human destiny. Therefore, the mystery of Golgotha not only concerns humanity, but also concerns the gods. It is an event which concerns them, and may be put somewhat as follows. The gods of the sun came together and consulted as to what they should do to rescue humanity from the danger threatening it, that of becoming weaker and weaker by reason of the shrinking of the astral body. Christ was, therefore, sent to the earth and went through birth and death, not, of course, as a human being, but as a divine being. The consequence was that through the event of Golgotha, through the fact of the death of Christ, the healing forces entered the earth evolution and were able to overcome the above-mentioned forces, which produced sickness in humanity. Thus, in a true cosmic, telluric sense of the words, Christ became the great healer of humanity, the Savior. His forces entered all that had to be healed in man, who thereby can go on his way in freedom, together with that which, while on the one hand it has the tendency to die out, on the other hand it will be healed by Christ. Thus, in the evolution of the world, care was taken that the mystery of Golgotha should come about before the year 333. The earth evolution of humanity pursued such a course, and unavoidably so, that in the year 333 mankind had reached the beginning of dissolution, the beginning of a general sickening all the earth over. Through the mystery of Golgotha came the great salvation. Whatever man does, which though it may not be of his own self-consciousness, yet it tends in the deeper forces of humanity to destruction, can be healed in the future by Christ, by the union with Christ. That is the position occupied by the mystery of Golgotha in the evolution of the earth and of humanity. During the first 3 centuries after Christ, and in the beginning of the 4th century, there were a few persons who had taken into themselves the spiritual life of that time, and they still knew something of the facts just mentioned. In all the ages before the mystery of Golgotha, there were the ancient mysteries within which the pupils were taught something of human evolution on earth in the past, and also of the coming Christ, of that which was to be accomplished in the future ages of human evolution. In great and mighty pictures there was revealed to the pupils of the mysteries the connection of man on earth with the spiritual beings of the higher worlds. At the time of the mystery of Golgotha, there were still individuals scattered over the regions of Asia Minor, Africa, and the south of Europe, who were more advanced than the rest, and who preserved, in what came later to be known as the Gnosis, something of the knowledge and wisdom present in the evolution of the earth and of humanity, and which, in the mystery of Golgotha, played so powerful a part for humanity. These men, who still knew the secrets of the old mysteries, were, however, filled with deep sorrow. They knew that a crisis must come for humanity. They knew that man's understanding would not, in the time approaching, extend to that which could help him to comprehend the really deeper foundations of evolution on earth and in humanity. Thus a kind of anxiety, not connected with their own earthly affairs, can be perceived in certain personalities of the first 4 centuries of Christianity. They were filled with an anxiety extending to the affairs of the whole world evolution, which can be summarized in this question: will humanity mature itself sufficiently? Will it be ripe enough to take into itself what has come about through the mystery of Golgotha? That was the great question of those who may be called the successors of the old initiates during the first 4 centuries after the mystery of Golgotha. From the circle of those who might still be designated the initiates of Christianity in the early centuries after Christ, there went forth a wonderful poem. It first related the appearance of Christ on earth, and then went on to depict in impressive form, in a quite dramatic way, though the poem was really an epic, and in mighty pictures, the humanity of the near future, which would not be able to reach up to what it was necessary they should be able to understand for the salvation of the evolution of mankind. After mighty pictures representing something of what I have described as the decision of the council of the sun gods, the poem goes on to depict in a very impressive way the descent of the Christ into the man, Jesus of Nazareth. And in the third part it depicts how, in a new metamorphosis, the old Demeter and the Isis being were to come to life again and take part in human evolution. It describes how Demeter and the Isis being were to be saved, and this is represented in a very powerful and very human form. It is represented as something which is promised to man, and which will play a part in the future. These poet-priests of the first 4 Christian centuries represented, or at least the most prominent of them did, how in the further evolution of the earth a certain cult was to be established, which would be practiced by all those who wished to acquire scholarship and enter the intellectual life. In this epic, there then follows a description of a young man whom we find completely involved in this evolution, spending his early years in the development of a worship of the Virgin Mary, which was to form a bridge between his early life and his later years. This practice was to influence all the learned men, as well as those being trained for scholarship and those seeking wisdom. It was to help humanity to find union with that which came into the world through the mystery of Golgotha. This act of sacrifice was described in living colors, and thus a mighty poem, rich in color, came into being during the first four Christian centuries. Among those who lived more or less in the atmosphere of this poem were also the painter-priests, who, in a simple and popular style, presented these scenes in mighty pictures which went straight to the hearts of the people. This poem really existed, but together with all else which actually originated in the Gnosis, it was later destroyed by the Church. If we remember that even in much later times the writings of Scotus Origina were only saved by what is called a mere chance, we need not consider it absurd that spiritual science should reveal the fact that the greatest poem ever inspired by the New Testament was entirely wiped out of existence, so much so that the after ages retained no trace of it. This poem, which once existed, was utterly destroyed, together with the simple yet stirring pictures attached to it. Therein was esoterically hidden the immeasurable sorrow felt by those successors of the old initiates in the early Christian centuries. An earnest, plaintive note prevailed throughout the whole poem. We may say that up to the 4th century, and even at the beginning of the 5th, it was still possible for certain men who did not follow the Augustinian school, but belonged to an altogether different stream of thought, to understand these things. They still had the necessary kind of understanding. But this could not be maintained in the direct way possible at that time. Life had already become too narrow in its outlook to those living in the southern parts of Europe, and the right understanding could no longer be found. So it came about that the underlying understanding, then existing, was hardened and crystallized into the dogmas which have persisted, and which have really only been retained because Latin, a dead and dying language, preserved what there was. The propagation of the Latin tongue in the Middle Ages by those who then achieved wisdom was for the purpose of congealing into language what once was a living understanding. All that was formerly known of the Trinity, Christ becoming man, of the descent of the Holy Spirit, and the great process of redemption, of which I have spoken, all this was congealed into dogmas which were propagated in the Latin tongue. The words themselves no longer bore any relation to what was the true content. Thus, gradually, in the erudition of the West, of which the Latin tongue was the medium, what lived as a phosphorescent figure in this now extinct poem was rooted out and done away with. Then came all the youthful races from a more eastern direction and from the north, and they began to take up the Christ impulse in the absolutely Latinized form into which it was already becoming frozen. We must picture the already congealing Christ impulse moving up from the south into the different peoples spreading in the north. They received an already frozen Christianity, while their youthful spiritual forces had not as yet the powers to bring to life, out of the hardened dogmas, the greatness concealed therein. The after effects of all these things are still present today. We still see in the northern regions forces which have apparently, for all this is only apparent, received too late the Christ impulse, which is hardened beneath the surface into dry dogmas. These peoples are, however, intended to find again, of their own free will, from direct spiritual perception, the whole secret of the fact of Golgotha and of the entrance of Christ into the life of earth. for the very circumstance that after the year 333 the congealed Christianity was drawn from Italy, while youthful peoples arrived whose descendants are everywhere. For in Russia, Sweden, Norway, Central Europe, England, the people still live under this impulse. All this really came about that men might finally grasp the Christ impulse of their own free will. It is therefore the task, and forms part of the civilization, of those peoples to whom Anthroposophy principally addresses itself today, to grasp the whole connection of Christ Jesus, and to learn to understand that without the Christ impulse, humanity would have congealed into a self-destroying process. We are only able to speak in physical words because the Christ impulse has gone right into the physical to bring about the physical healing of humanity. Christ has become the great phosphorus, the spiritual phosphorus, who works against this process of salting in man. Quote, Christus verus phosphorus, close quote, is one of those sayings uttered in the first 3 centuries of Christianity. This great phosphorus passes as the leading motive through the lost poem mentioned above. Thus, we must take our place between the past and the future. Thus must we be able to look back. Of course, I am not forcing upon you what I have just said about an extinct poem and a lost erudition. I am not asking you to accept this as a dogma. Such is far from being my intention. But the methods which lead to the investigation into the true spiritual course of humanity lead to as certain a knowledge of such facts as do those by means of which the facts of natural science are discovered today. Indeed, they are established more surely than the hypothesis of modern natural science. Just as no one is in any sense obliged to examine these things, if the materialistic opinions of the present day have prejudiced him against them, so one who knows these things, as he knows his own life, cannot be restrained from speaking of them to those who from a sound feeling for the whole trend of man's evolution are able to realize the truth of such an impulse in evolution. The poem to which I have referred was no longer extant after the 4th post-Christian century, but all sorts of stories were related of it, not in records but by word of mouth, and repeated in small circles by one man to another. In these limited circles the remembrance of this poem lived on. These circles were prevented by the ruling church circles then rising to power from speaking openly about the poem which played such a part in the 3 to 4 centuries. However, among those who still dimly surmised something of what this poem meant, and the soul disposition of mankind from which it proceeded, there was one man who was able to gather up what he learned of it, though in a greatly altered form, no longer possessing the greatness of the early centuries. This man was the teacher of Dante. We may say that in a sense Dante's Commedia was written under a certain inspiration, reaching over from the early centuries, although even so it was influenced by the dogmas then prevailing. I am, of course, well aware that many objections could be raised to such a presentation of history today, and I can make the same objections myself. But although I fully recognize and respect the exactitude with which our history is constructed, that history which mankind studies in the elementary and secondary schools, and which rests both on documents and on conscientious historical criticism, yet what is the good of it? Mankind cannot but admit that this cannot be true history, for the documents concerning it had not been preserved, but destroyed by the agency of man as time went on. No matter how conscientiously and critically the existing documents are investigated, we can only learn true history, as also true knowledge of nature and the heavens, from spiritual investigation. Therefore mankind must have the courage not only to speak of the stellar world, as has been done here in the last few days, but must also acquire the courage to add to the common presentation of history what is lacking therein, because of the fact that certain interested circles wished these other documents completely to disappear. however, among the impulses living in the human soul, these that were thus extinguished in documentary form still live on. These impulses that once upon a time were living impulses in mankind still live on, although not in documentary form. They live on in that which modern man can learn to understand. As mankind passes on in the course of evolution to the future already prepared for it, it will not only have to unlearn many of its concepts and ideas, but will also have to alter its attitude toward the truth. For the main thing is that we must once more find the Christ. He must come again, and his return presupposes the presence of a humanity in this century capable of understanding the way in which he will show himself, and the manner of his appearance. Otherwise the most dreadful and disturbing movements may arise, in which men in their profoundly subconscious selves will guess something of the return of Christ, that is to say of his spirit, but will spread the matter abroad in an external, trivial, and most alarming way. Clear understanding can only enter human evolution in preparation for the near future, if the circle of those who accept, in the right frame of mind, the true methods of spiritual research, and of discovering what it is that mankind needs, to construct itself aright in the near future, if this circle becomes larger and larger. Otherwise we shall sink more and more deeply into that which can never really draw near to the spiritual, not so much on account of false concepts and ideas, but because of a wrong attitude of mind. Indeed, there is much in the concepts and ideas of the present time which seems to be a strengthening, a tendency toward what must be the real aim of knowledge in the future. Yet it is something which hinders men from looking at the discoveries of natural science in the right light. They are groping in the dark, as it were, with respect to these facts. At the present time, when medical scientific views are being widely published, you know that there are persons who in later life fall into a nervous state, which extends to their physical constitution and leads to real illnesses. Modern medical science finds itself incapable in any way of overcoming these forms of illness. They cannot extend the science of medicine far enough to effect a cure. I myself was a direct contemporary of the celebrated Viennese physician Breuer at the time when he was confronted with a case in which something appeared in a patient which could not physically be accounted for by pathological methods of research. Recourse was taken to hypnosis, which was then coming increasingly into favor. The patient was hypnotized, and by this means it was discovered that in his early life he had been through a shocking and dreadful experience. This had, in a sense, withdrawn into the lower regions of human life, those regions in which the subconscious, the unconscious, are located. That, at any rate, was the explanation given at that time. And there it had formed a concealed province of the soul. Now, although a man may know nothing about all this, it may nevertheless be present in his life and be productive of illness. Thus, there had been something in the patient which was only a psychic experience, but which in its after effects worked on and formed, as it were, an isolated part of his soul life, of which he was not conscious. The conclusion then arrived at was that if the patient could be reminded of this, if it could be brought to his mind so that he grasped it consciously, it might lead to his recovery. Such facts are becoming increasingly common, but if we want to know why mankind should be subject to such conditions, which will become more and more frequent, we must learn from spiritual knowledge what is happening to the decreasing astral body, and how in the increasing lower part of the astral body there is a tendency to collect these isolated soul provinces. If we wish to explain these phenomena, we must rise from the knowledge of the soul nature of man to the historical knowledge of his spirit, to the cosmic knowledge of the spirit. Breuer was of an inferior nature. As I said, I knew him very well. And when he saw that he could get no further along these lines with the knowledge possessed at the present time, he dropped the threads of research, so to speak. These were taken up by others, above all by Freud and his successors, Thus what is now known as psychoanalysis, which is everywhere at work, came into being. It is founded absolutely on truth, for the phenomena certainly are there, and people are forced to search in the psychic for what is expressed in the physical. The idea is correct, but the science is not there which can rule it. This can only be done by spiritual science. Thus, psychoanalysis, which rests upon an entirely historical, natural defect of the upper astral body of man, comes forward with its facts and is handled by persons who in the first place are dilettante in psychological investigation, as also in spiritual research, and who are also dilettante as regards their investigations of the human body, for they do not know how to discover the spirit in the body. Suppose two such persons of similar caliber come together, knowing as little of the real psychic and spiritual life of man as they do of the physical and etheric life. When two equal greatnesses affect each other, they multiply. A times A equals A squared, or D times D equals D squared. Dilettante times dilettante equals dilettante to the square. It is actually the case that something correct in itself, something resting on quite correct foundations, by reason of the incapacity of the present-day research, comes before the world as dilettante. Yet in all this, one can see the endeavor being made to reach the truth. Psychoanalysis must not be represented as belonging to the devil, but rather as something in which our age is trying to do what it cannot succeed in doing. Thus what comes forward as psychoanalysis will only take its place when it rests on spiritual research. Unless that is done, it will remain at the stage reached by the Swiss scientist Jung, who has worked out a very curious system of logic in this connection. In his writings you can find the following sentences, for example, quote, "Man is capable, by reason of these historically concealed soul provinces, of admitting a divine being." The writer, being of course of an atheistic turn of mind, goes on to say, "Only of course there can be no divine being." It is thus that psychoanalysis states that man should admit a divine being. That implies no less, if a man is really conscientious, and I always recognize the conscientiousness and exactitude of such a man as Jung, then saying to ourselves, we must live on falsehood, for we cannot live with the truth. Atheism is untruth. We must live with atheism. These things are not taken seriously enough by the development of the present day. They should be taken in full earnestness. Subconscious longings are becoming apparent in all directions, though men are not aware of them. Some of those here present, who have heard or read other courses of lectures which I have given, will know that speaking from spiritual perception, I have often drawn attention to the fact that it is constantly said, quote, "Light radiates from the sun and goes forth into infinite space, endlessness." Close quote. At the best, the sign of infinity is then added, and it is said, quote, "Light goes forth endlessly into cosmic space, lessens in intensity with the square of distance, the intensity decreasing more and more, and thus it disappears." Close quote. I have often said to my hearers, spiritual vision tells a different story. The idea that light radiates from a center, going further and further out, is not correct. It is just like a tightly strung bow, which, when it is drawn, only goes a certain distance in the opposite direction and then returns. Thus, light spreads out to a certain point but always returns. Not only does it expand, but it is elastic, rhythmic, in its expansion. The sun not only rays forth light, but constantly receives the returning light. Now, since at the end of the light's course the intensities differ, the courses followed by the light can take different forms. I only wish to give a hint of this, which is the result of the union of a higher knowledge, a cosmic knowledge of the world, with a true knowledge of spiritual science. The papers are just now announcing that Sir Oliver Lodge has been demonstrating in a lecture that a ray of light extends to a certain distance, and then, meeting with absence of matter, this is accepted as something with which it comes in contact, falls back into itself again, with the help of the metamorphosis of the electrons. This is a thought which, compared with the real truth, is dilettante. I hope you will not take this as a lack of respect for science. I fully recognize science. But compared with the truth, such things as these, though they cannot be too highly praised and appreciated in their brilliancy at the present time, are yet but dilettante as compared with the reality. On the other hand, they show how man's thought itself drives him, with abstract concepts of light radiations and electrons, to enter a region in which the reality is to be found. It is simply a question of coming to the reality, and of bringing into all the ideas arising in all directions, and of which no use can be made, that impulse which drives even modern research into spiritual domains. In certain occult circles, foolish practices are carried on. People are taught all sorts of occult doctrines which do not lead to the ultimate point in which this life originated. They are given pictures, but are not led to the origin of the pictures, to that of which they are the image. Thus they are surrounded in their souls with a world of pictures, instead of having the feeling that they must learn through these pictures to know the universe. For this reason, after publishing my book Theosophy, I followed it up with Esoteric Science. In the latter, which had been represented in pictures in Theosophy, is carried into the reality of the stellar world, in the evolution through Saturn, Sun, and Moon. These two books complete each other. If in any sphere a man is given nothing but pictures, he will be surrounded by them. People who carry on wrong occult practices do this with those pupils of whom they have not gained complete possession, and by this means the latter are, as it were, occultly imprisoned. In these occult prisons, man is surrounded by pictures which are not comprehensible to him, and from which he cannot escape. By this means, many evil occult practices have been and still are being carried on. There are also spiritual beings who lead man, or part of man, into these occult prisons. This is a quite similar phenomenon. These spiritual beings are set free in nature if we have no spiritual understanding of it, and regard it in such a way that the atomistic processes are taken as being naturalistic, which means denying the spirit in nature. The so-called Aramanic beings, striving in opposition to man, then become active in nature and deceive man with all sorts of pictures. Thus he may be led into occult captivity by these Aramanic spiritual beings. A great number of what are today known as scientific conceptions of nature, not the scientific facts, these are good, are nothing but the pictures of a universal captivity, the danger of which is hanging over the head of humanity. Such a danger exists in the fact that man is everywhere surrounded by atomic and molecular pictures. An occult custody surrounds us with these pictures, and we cannot perceive the free spiritual and stellar pictures, because the world of the atoms forms, as it were, the psychic walls which enclose us in a prison in which we are spiritually confined. This is a picture which, illumined by spiritual science, can show us a real struggle going on at the present time. For the facts of natural science are becoming more and more fruitful and can lead us into spiritual distances if they are not met with the prejudices of the occult captivity in which science is really enclosed today. These are the things which we must experience inwardly if we are to take our proper place at the present time in the evolution of the world and of humanity, in conformity with the past and future of the earth and of humanity. We are always confronted with this when we come in touch with any of the old strivings, which we now see illumined by the soul and the spirit. When we climb the mountains here and find the ancient druid memorials, which represent the spiritual striving of olden times, they may be to us a reminder of how those ancient men strove for the Spirit and looked up in their own way to the coming Christ, and how only then they reached their fulfillment. We too may now again have a spiritual knowledge gained by spiritual vision, through which we in our way shall perceive the coming Christ, who must return, because he must be perceived by mankind in his spiritual form, the living form in which he went through the mystery of Golgotha. In this region, where such beautiful old memorials have been preserved, we all feel special gratitude to those who arranged for our course of lectures to be given here, What I still wish to add in this respect, I shall say in my farewell speech this evening, the end of the last lecture, Lecture 13. And there's an additional extract.